your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got quite a program this evening. We're going to cover Andrew McCabe and so forth in the latest revelations. And also, we're going to be featuring some an in-depth interview that Judicial Watch had. So that's what we're going to start off with, and that's going to establish what's been going on about Andrew McCabe here this week, and then we'll fill in with some other current news, and then end with Leo Zagami and his revelations about the Vatican. So here we go now with Judicial Watch's interview.
Welcome to Inside Judicial Watch. I'm your host, Bruce Schlesman. With me today, we have one of our senior investigators, Bill Marshall, who will be discussing our topic today, which is Andrew McCabe and the most recent lawsuit we have for his text messages. Thank you so much for joining the show today.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Bruce. Glad to be here.
Of course, of course. So why don't you take us into a little bit about this lawsuit and Andrew McCabe?
Right. Well, our most recent lawsuit, and we actually have a number of lawsuits against the FBI and DOJ for related to Andrew McCabe. But our most recent lawsuit we filed in connection with the Administrative Procedure Act. And the lawsuit basically says that the FBI came back in response to one of my FOIA requests where I had asked for all of his communications about his wife's Virginia State Senate campaign when she was running for the State Senate as a Democrat in Virginia in 2015. We asked for communications in any form regarding ethical guidance he received from the FBI about any potential conflicts of interest that you know, may have arisen, given his very senior role at the FBI and the fact that his wife received $700,000 from Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe's PAC called Common Good, as well as the Virginia Democratic Party, while her husband, Andrew McCabe, was involved in the Hillary Clinton email server investigation as head of the Washington field office. So essentially, the FBI came back. While they provided us with certain emails, they didn't provide us with any text messages.
Okay.
And this is very odd because we know that Lisa Page and Peter Strzok and other FBI and DOJ officials involved in the Hillary Clinton email server investigation were texting very, very heavily. So we found it very odd and not credible that Andrew McCabe himself had not been texting about the Hillary Clinton email investigation, about his wife's campaign and everything like that. So essentially the FBI came back and said to us, well, we're not going to provide you with text messages for Andrew McCabe because we don't feel we're required to supply them under the Freedom of Information Act. Now, it's been well established by the courts that text messages are, in fact, government communications, just like emails, just like written correspondence, and they are subject to FOIA. So essentially, the FBI was saying that, well, because we don't have an archiving and recording system in place for text messages, they don't fall under the Freedom of Information Act. So essentially, what our lawsuit does is, against our most recent lawsuit against the Department of Justice, is say that, no, text messages are government communications, and we are asking the court to order the FBI to establish a text message record-keeping system so that the FBI will be able to supply text messages as well as emails and other forms of communications to FOIA requesters in the future.
So you mentioned their side of the story, the side of the story that they're saying the reason they don't need to give us these texts. Would you mind going into a little bit more detail about the argument that they're making right now?
Right. Well, another lawsuit I would bring up is a very similar request that to the one I filed, requesting email communications and text messages and other forms of communication from Andrew McCabe relating to his wife Jill McCabe's state Senate campaign and all of the money that she was receiving from Hillary Clinton's good friend. And I should point this out that Governor McAuliffe, Terry McAuliffe, was a longtime associate of Bill and Hillary Clinton going all the way back to the 90s. So the same month that the FBI opened its its Hillary Clinton email server investigation, March 2015, was the month that Jill McCabe, Andrew McCabe's wife, started her state Senate campaign and received $700,000 from Hillary and Bill Clinton's good friend, Terry McAuliffe, and via his PAC, right, mm-hmm. called Common Good. So another individual that had filed a very similar FOIA request to mine was a retired FBI supervisor special agent named Jeffrey Danik. Danik had also asked for communications, emails, text messages regarding Jill McCabe's Senate campaign, any conflicts of interest involving her husband, Andrew McCabe, and that's what produced the affidavit from the FBI saying that text messages do not fall under the Freedom of Information Act.
So this all starts with Jill McCabe's campaign in 2015.
Yes, exactly. Right? This whole issue of our suing the FBI to force them, or to have the court, rather, force them to create a new record-keeping system which would capture text messages stems from my request and Jeffrey Danik's requests for Andrew McCabe's text messages involving his wife's campaign, her Senate campaign, and any conflicts of interest given his role mm-hmm. overseeing investigations that involve Hillary Clinton and as well as, by the way, Terry McAuliffe. This is another issue that people sometimes forget, is that Terry McAuliffe himself was under investigation by the FBI while Terry McAuliffe's PAC was giving money to a top FBI official's, Andrew McCabe's, wife, who was running for the state Senate campaign. Anybody looking at this case objectively, looking at the whole situation with Andrew McCabe and Andrew McCabe's wife getting money from the top Democrats while they were under investigation, anyone looking at that would say this is a gross conflict of interest. And this is what prompted, I believe, President Trump's question to Andrew McCabe very early after President Trump was inaugurated, asking him, what were you thinking when you did this? Did you see it as a conflict of interest? And this is the question that anyone who has been, like myself, has worked in government, worked in law enforcement, federal law enforcement, would ask. It beggars belief that any senior FBI official would not see this as a gross conflict of interest.
Gross conflict of interest is a great way of phrasing this, it seems to me. So for our audience and those not as knowledgeable about this case as you are, what was McCabe's role starting in 2015, and how could he have influenced the Clinton probe?
Well, that's a great question. At the time that his wife was asked to run for the by Terry McAuliffe to run for the Democratic Party ticket as a state senator, right, in Virginia, he was the FBI official in charge of the Washington field office of the FBI, one of the most senior officials in the FBI. So the very same month, as I said, that his wife launches her campaign for state Senate in Virginia as a Democrat and receives $700,000 from Terry McAuliffe's PAC and the Virginia Democratic Party, the FBI launches its investigation against Terry McAuliffe's good friend, Hillary Clinton, right, in March 2015. Now, supposedly, according to McCabe, he had no direct role, he claimed, in his role as the head of the Washington field office in Hillary Clinton's email server investigation. But he was supplying the agents who were who were overseeing that investigation. So that's a he's a pretty significant player in that whole scenario. And then a few months after Jill McCabe loses her election to the Virginia State Senate in November 2015, in February 2016, I believe it was, Andrew McCabe is promoted to the number two spot in the FBI deputy director, in which he does have direct oversight of Hillary Clinton's email server investigation. It doesn't, in my view, it doesn't get any more corrupt than this. Andrew McCabe was an absolutely corrupt official. And if he was not self-aware enough to understand that this represented a huge conflict of interest, then frankly he wasn't intelligent enough to be in the role of deputy director of the FBI.
Okay. And so he was obviously fired by President Trump.
Yes, he was fired, I want to say, in February of 2018.
Okay.
He took over, he became the acting director of the FBI in May 2017 when James Comey was fired for his own ethical issues by President Trump.
Do those two ethical issues overlap in this case?
Well, the issues dealing with Andrew McCabe, as determined by the Inspector General of DOJ, and the Office of Professional Responsibility at the FBI, his ethical issues primarily concerned his leaking to the media.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew McCabe was leaking specifically to the Wall Street Journal, among others, I think, as well as other reporters, based on other records I have gotten, email traffic that I've gotten from Andrew McCabe. But the issue that the Inspector General addressed in looking at Andrew McCabe was his unauthorized leaks to the Wall Street Journal, specifically Devlin Barrett, concerning a story that he leaked to the Journal through his top aides, Lisa Page, who is you'll be familiar with, and Michael Corten, who was the Assistant Director of the FBI for Public Affairs. What they leaked about was tensions that were occurring between the FBI and DOJ over the FBI's investigation of corruption at the Clinton Foundation. And essentially, Andrew McCabe, through his conduits, Lisa Page and Michael Corten, was telling the Journal that there was an ongoing investigation at the FBI into the Clinton Foundation. That leak outraged the DOJ officials because they didn't want this known while... This is October 2016, right before Hillary Clinton's the election is going to be determined as to whether she becomes president. And suddenly here you have, you know, Andrew McCabe leaking to the Wall Street Journal that the Clinton Foundation is under investigation. What the Inspector General found was that he not only was leaking to the media, which he had some ability and authority to do in certain cases. In this case, he was leaking purely out of self-interest, not out of the FBI's interests. And furthermore, he lied on four occasions to federal investigators who were questioning him about his leaks, his media leaks, three times under oath. That's a very serious violation. When an FBI official, what they call, the way the FBI frames it, is lax candor when being questioned about official actions. What that means in FBI speak is lied. Okay, he lied to federal investigators. That's a violation of federal law. It's called Section 1001. It's a big deal.
So that's a crime.
That is a crime, and he is now actively being investigated by the Justice Department.
Okay.
Criminally investigated on that issue.
Just to go back to the money that you mentioned with Jill McCabe, that when did that money come in and went to the timeline of when he was promoted to deputy director and started to interfere with the Clinton probe?
Right. Well, she was initially approached by Governor McAuliffe. This is Jill McCabe. This is Andrew McCabe's wife, who is, by the way, a physician in Virginia. She's, I think, a pediatrician. She was initially offered this opportunity to run as a Democrat for the Virginia State Senate at the very end of February 2015. Couple of days later, the New York Times story breaks, revealing Hillary's use of a private email server to traffic all of this classified information, and so forth. Now, initially, some campaign funds were were offered to Jill McCabe at the outset when she was first offered this opportunity. But 98% of the funds that were received by Jill McCabe came after the FBI launched its investigation of Hillary Clinton.
Wow.
Right. So this is, this is at this time, Andrew McCabe is deciding on which agents will conduct the Hillary Clinton email server investigation while his wife is getting funds from Hillary Clinton's good friend, Terry McAuliffe. You know, such an obviously corrupt situation.
Very, very. So we've talked about the IG report, which we have here, mm-hmm. and I'd like to talk a little bit about what that found and what it means to our lawsuit that we're suing for the texts.
Well, yeah, I mean, and again, the IG focused, the IG's report focused primarily on these unauthorized media leaks mm-hmm. by the self-serving media leaks by Andrew McCabe. And then, probably more significantly, his lying about those leaks to federal investigators who are questioning him about it. Now, as to how they, you know, how that all factors into to our lawsuits, I think the fact that Andrew McCabe was the genesis—that is to say, it was all of the ethical issues, or and my FOIA requests and our ensuing litigation. That finally brought this to the fore. The fact that the FBI does not have a system in place to capture and archive and make available to requesters like ourselves text messages which clearly fall under the definition of official government communications. Mm-hmm. So we basically have Andrew McCabe to thank for this effort to get the courts to force the FBI. And by extension, all other federal agencies, to develop a system in which they will capture all government communications, including text messages, including encrypted app communications. This is an issue that we've been dealing with for years, and I think that finally this whole situation surrounding Andrew McCabe, we're hoping, will result in in a mechanism that will force government agencies to comply. Because at this point in time, text messages have become ubiquitous, a ubiquitous form of communication between everyone. We all text. And now emails, while they're a very important form of communication, text messaging has become almost equally important in communicating between government officials. The really shocking thing is that the FBI told us in their, in their filings, their court filings, in the case of Jeffrey Danik, we represented, again, Jeffrey Danik, the retired FBI agent, in his case against the FBI, an individual named Michael Seidel, who is the assistant section chief of the Records Information Dissemination Section of the FBI, said in a search declaration or an affidavit, he said that FBI agents are expected to, of their own free will and of their own volition, save records, text mm-hmm. messages that are relevant to government business. So in other words, there's no one overseeing them. There's no controlling element. There's no one to ensure that they are complying with the law. It's all based on the honor system. Well, if you're doing something nefarious, obviously you're not going to adhere to that honor system. I mean, you're already breaking the law possibly, or you're violating ethics, or doing, engaging in some kind of behavior which is unethical. Well, why would you then, adhere to some rule telling you have to save those communications regarding unethical activity? It just defies belief that the FBI would have such a policy in place.
Absolutely. This new rule, would it help us get the text that we want from McCabe, or is it kind of too late for that?
I'm afraid it might be too late because he may have deleted them. Somebody raised the question with me recently in another interview. Well, why do we have the Lisa Page, the thousands of Lisa Page and Peter Strzok text messages? You'll recall that Peter Strzok was the FBI official directly overseeing the Hillary Clinton's email server investigation, and Lisa Page was a top FBI attorney, the top aide, in fact, to Andrew McCabe. They were lovers, and they were texting furiously between back and forth about very political work related stuff, and on there, but they were using their government issued cell phones. That's the difference. So the IG's office actually got a hold of their physical phones or devices, and they were able to extract all of their text messages from their phones. Now, whether or not Andrew McCabe was using his government-issued cell phone to text, we don't know. But the FBI claims that the FBI claimed in their lawsuit, in our lawsuit against them for Jeffrey Danik, they had conducted an audit, right, of the Andrew McCabe's text messages. Well, in a separate request, we went back and we said, okay, we want a copy of that audit. Right. So if you said you did an audit, we want a copy of it. And they haven't provided that yet. Okay. So we're now suing for that as well, for that audit.
OK, so that's another lawsuit that's ongoing. And yes, we might see that audit. Yet.
Exactly. No. Yeah. So we'll see. So I'd like to thank Andrew McCabe in a way for bringing this issue
to light
and for raising it as a really important one, because if government officials are going to communicate via text message, they should have a system in place where we know about it. We, the American people, have access to those text messages and can view them. I mean, we're doing the work we do on behalf of the American people. We're trying to hold our government accountable using the tools, specifically the Freedom of Information Act, that are available to us. At this point, our country is in a state where we can no longer trust the FBI. It's very sad. I've always had tremendous respect for the FBI. I formerly worked for the DEA, which is a sister agency to the FBI, and I've always had great respect for them. I got to tell you, in the last few years, it's a sorry state of affairs that we've reached, where the FBI is actively working to benefit certain political figures whom they favor, and to work against those that they don't, and specifically I'm referring to Donald Trump.
So where does Judicial Watch go from here?
Well, we'll see what the answers. The FBI will be required to submit answers to our Administrative Procedure Act request. This is the request for the court order the FBI to create a system to archive text messages. They have 60 days to respond to that, so that'll be like mid-December.
So what happens if they don't meet 60 days?
Well, that's a good question. They may file a request for summary judgment to have the case dismissed. But we'll brief this case, meaning that we will go before the judge and argue that they shouldn't be allowed to dismiss this case, and here are the reasons.
Okay.
And we think we are hopeful that Judge Rudy Contreras, who I believe is hearing this case, will find in our favor. And, we'll recognize that the Freedom of Information Act does apply to text messages, too.
Yeah, well, hopefully. Thank you so much for this enlightening conversation and briefing us all on this topic.
My pleasure. And thank you for addressing it. I think it's a very important matter.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Inside Judicial Watch. Please support our work and subscribe and like us on social media and follow us for more episodes and more topics like this as we continue to fight corruption in government. Thank you so much.
Next up is a special report by Catherine Harris on Tucker Carlson's show. And she's going to give us and fill in some of the details on the Andrew McCabe controversy that's ongoing now. So here we go with a report by Catherine Harris on Tucker Carlson. Here we go. Listen carefully. Great report.
You've heard people who seem a little paranoid, to be honest, talk about a coup. Now they don't seem quite as crazy. In a new interview, former FBI Deputy Director Andy McCabe admitted that Justice Department officials discussed launching an administrative coup d'etat against the President of the United States. The official, says McCabe, considered asking the President's cabinet to invoke the never-invoked 25th Amendment to the Constitution as a way to remove Trump from power, obviously without an election or an impeachment hearing. Fox Chief Intelligence Correspondent Catherine Herridge is on the story and has details for us tonight. Catherine.
Well, thank you, Tucker. McCabe went on the record confirming our reporting from October that he believed the Justice Department's second-in-command was serious about recording the president and invoking the 25th Amendment. The timing matters because May 2017 is a pivotal month in the Russia probe. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was just 2 weeks into the job when President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. 8 days later, Rosenstein appointed the special counsel. McCabe also tells CBS News that after Comey was fired, the FBI launched an obstruction of justice case, in addition to the FBI's ongoing investigation into alleged Russia collusion. In a statement, the Justice Department seemed to stop short of denying Rosenstein talked about removing the president. Quote, the Deputy Attorney General never authorized any recording that Mr. McCabe references. Based on his personal dealings with the president, there's no basis to invoke the 25th Amendment. In a tweet, President Trump hit back, disgraced FBI Acting Director Andrew McCabe pretends to be a poor little angel when in fact he was a big part of the crooked Hillary scandal and the Russia hoax, a puppet for lying James Comey. And for some context, Andrew McCabe was fired last year for lying to federal investigators. That case is now with the U.S. attorney here in Washington. Tucker.
Catherine Herridge, thank you very
much.
You're
welcome.
I appreciate it.
Up next, we're going to move on to President Trump has declared an emergency, a national emergency, because of the border to our south. And he's getting all kinds of flack from the Democrats. They're saying they're trying to redefine what emergency is. And they're saying that President Trump does not have the power nor the rights to declare a national emergency because of the immigration problem to the south. We all think that, yeah, there's too many people coming in and he's well warranted in doing this. Press Secretary Sanders, was quizzed recently in defense of what the president is trying to do. And here we go with what she had to say as press secretary speaking for the president.
I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster. And I don't have to do it for the election. I've already done a lot of wall for the election, 2020. And the only reason we're up here talking about this is because of the election.
President Trump making his emergency declaration to build a border wall earlier this morning. Let's bring in White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders. Great to have you on the daily briefing on this great day on a Friday where it's nice there in Washington, D.C., and the president was able to be in the Rose Garden today, took a lot of questions from the press. Critics of his seizing on this line that I didn't need to do this in regards to the national emergency, and some saying that that will be the opening line of every legal complaint that goes forward. How will you deal with that as press secretary?
Look, I think the biggest thing is that he shouldn't have to do this. Congress should have stepped up and done their jobs and done everything necessary to fully and safely secure the border. The president could have waited and he could have drug this out. The bill allows for 55 new miles of wall, which is a great step forward, and it is certainly a down payment on the wall, but it doesn't finish the job. And the president is somebody who wants to complete the job, he wants to finish the job, and he wants to stop illegal immigrants and drugs and trafficking from coming across the border, and he knows that you have to have a wall in order to do that. He doesn't want to drag this out over the course of the next several years. He wants to get the funding now so we can stop this national security and humanitarian crisis at the border and take care of it.
Mm-hmm. I was remembering, of course, people have played the clip that President Trump was quite critical of President Obama years ago, but I wondered if he's found that now that he's in the Oval Office, he's realized that working with Congress is kind of a pain in the rear, and they might have something in common now.
I'm sure that they can probably find a little bit of common ground in the fact that Congress can certainly be difficult to work with. But the difference between the president, between President Trump and President Obama is apples and oranges. What President Obama did in 2014 was he completely ignored the Constitution. He violated federal law by opening up the borders, by having mass amnesty, and even providing benefits to illegal immigrants. What the president is doing is actually fulfilling his constitutional duty, fulfilling the oath that he took as President of the United States to protect the people of this country, to secure our country. And there's a very big difference between what the two actions these individuals have done. They're actually opposite when you compare them. And so it's just totally different circumstances.
What about the concern from some that say that this could set a terrible precedent in the future? And I thought of former Senator Harry Reid, who basically used a nuclear option on confirmations, and that has led to President Trump being able to confirm two very conservative Supreme Court nominees, and there's a legacy issue there. Any concern on that point?
I think the president is going to have an incredible legacy. He's had an amazing 2 years already, historic first 2 years in office, and I think his next 6 years are going to be equally impactful. And I think that the two Supreme Court justices are something that are going to be one of the biggest and best parts of the president's legacy, and certainly one of the most lasting, and something he should never apologize for is pushing forward. The sad part is that he had to do that. He shouldn't have to do that in order to put people. He is the duly elected president of the United States. 63 million Americans came out and supported him and said, I want this person, this man, to choose who the next Supreme Court justice is, who the federal judges are. I want this person to be able to make decisions and impact the day-to-day life of these people.
I totally get it. My point only was that Harry Reid had made a decision that now has come back to bite the Democrats, and they have to deal with that. I also wanted to ask you about this because I thought it was very interesting the way the president answered a question about conservatives having, I think, perhaps over-exaggerated influence on the president. This just in from Ann Coulter. This is a tweet from her just now about an hour ago. She says, this is not Paul Ryan's fault. It's not Mitch McConnell's fault. Trump ran against the GOP and won. Responsibility is 100% his. Do you think the media over-exaggerates the influence that somebody like Ann Coulter has on the White House?
I don't think Ann Coulter has any influence over this White House or influence over much of anything, to be honest. I don't think she did before the president became the president, and I don't think she does now. I just don't see her as being an influential voice in this country, and certainly not one in this building.
Does the president have a plan to deal with the difficulties that eminent domain could put in front of him as this national emergency goes forward, tries to build the wall? There's a lot of private citizens there, a lot of private property. Does he have a plan for that?
Certainly he's going to continue working with the Department of Justice, Department of Defense, as well as White House counsel, who will be handling those issues. We feel very comfortable about where we are. And again, we know that the president certainly has the constitutional authority to make this type of declaration, and we feel very good about where we are in the process.
Take a listen to what the president said. Of course, you were there, but I just want to play it for the viewers about drugs and the death penalty.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part.
Our criminalist, a drug dealer, gets a thing called, how about a fine? And when I asked President Xi, I said, do you have a drug problem? No, no, no. I said, you have 1.4 billion people. What do you mean you have no drug problem? No, we don't have a drug problem. I said, why? Death penalty.
Okay, so the president just did a pretty amazing thing with the First Step Act, and that was helping a lot of people in our country be able to resolve their problems with the justice system because of drug penalties that they had to pay. Is the president actually going to put forward anything that would change our laws on this issue?
Legislation or executive action the president would take on that front. I think the point he's making is that we have to be tough. We can't allow people who bring in mass quantities of things like fentanyl, who can wipe out an entire community. They picked up at the border just within the last few weeks enough fentanyl that would kill 50 million Americans. I mean, that is an unbelievable just travesty. And the fact that we just those people are allowed to go free in some cases or not be able to be detained for long stretches of time. I think that type of thing is something the president wants to look at, and he certainly wants to be tough on those people.
Can I do one other question, not about the national emergency? I want to ask you about Amazon. New York, this is President Trump's home state. Amazon was going to bring 25,000 jobs to Long Island City. They decided to pull out of that yesterday. Governor Cuomo blamed Mayor de Blasio. Amazon blamed unnamed politicians. New York looks like it's hostile to big business coming in and creating jobs. Does the president have a view on this?
Look, I haven't spoken with him directly about that process. I know the president is somebody who loves companies who are creating jobs, and that's certainly a good thing. He's created an environment that has made that possible, which is why we've seen such a massive influx in the number of people that have gone back to work, and we have now more jobs open for people who actually want to work than we've had in decades. So that's something certainly the president supports, but I'm not going to get in the middle of a Democrat New York politics right now, but I think it'll be fun to watch those folks battle it out for sure.
I know. I used to try to avoid Texas politics as much as possible. All right, Sarah Sanders, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
You bet. Thanks, Dana.
Now, that was quite interesting from Sarah Sanders. And what's coming up next is a very, very insightful conversation with Stuart Rhodes, founder of Oath Keepers. And Alex Jones is interviewing him, and Stuart makes a very important point that Trump, being the commander-in-chief, can take action to protect our borders independent of any statute law because it's based in the Constitution. So here you go with Alex Jones and Stuart Rhodes. And Stuart Rhodes, like I said, is founder of the Oath Keepers. He's a fine, fine person.
Stuart Rhodes, we're going to get to more of his declaration a few hours ago. And, of course, you're a constitutional law graduate, have practiced law, but you've dedicated yourself now to Oath Keepers that you founded. But, you know, specifically as a veteran and a patriot, I mean, you wanted Trump to declare an emergency, but you're saying he didn't have to do it through the 70s law.
No, he didn't have to use the 1976 Declaration of Emergencies Act. He could have just pointed to his responsibilities as the commander-in-chief. In fact, he didn't have to declare emergency at all. All he had to do was issue the orders to the military to go to the border and secure them against the military enemies. The cartels are unconventional warfare.
The president doesn't need authorization if the Chinese launch ICBMs.
Well, precisely.
And so if the border is being overrun, he doesn't have to go, you know.
Well, yeah, and the cartels are international terrorists. They use the force and the threat of force to control terrain inside of Mexico. They're very much like Pancho Villa was.
They use terror.
Yeah, they use terror. And inside the United States, along the entire border, there are towns that are half illegal alien. Just the other day, I was down in Eagle Pass, and a Marine Corps veteran and law enforcement veteran there gave us a tour and let us know that half the people there are illegal aliens. 20,000 American citizens, another 20,000 illegal aliens. And the cartel runs that town. They control everything. And so they use force through force to control behavior and control politicians. That's the current definition in federal law of terrorism. And they are international. So they're an international terrorist organization. He should say they are just like ISIS, just like Al-Qaeda. They are international terrorists in a war on terror, a global war on terror, and they're unconventional warfare, fourth-generation warfare military opponents of the United States who are taking over territory in Mexico and in the United States.
And by the way, you and I have been big opponents of creeping, mission creep, martial law, police state. This is the opposite. Letting cartels take over is the definition of a foreign terroristic police state. It's the duty of the executive branch, the president, to stop it.
It's the primary function of government is to preserve life, liberty, and property, and to guarantee to our posterity the blessings of liberty. National defense is the most important function of our government and the most important function of the president's commander-in-chief. That's why in Article 2 it says he will be the commander-in-chief of the armed forces and of the militia, and that's us, when called into service, period. And he has obligation and duty to carry out all the guarantees, including guaranteeing each state a Republican form of government. It says there that the national government will guarantee to each state a Republican form of government. If you have the cartels taking over your counties and towns and your sheriff departments and your police chiefs, how is that a Republican form of government?
And as you know, for 10 years, Arizona, 30, 40, 50 miles in, has signs saying, do not go down, we're talking concrete roads in some cases, this is controlled by cartels.
Exactly. We can't guarantee your safety. We advise you not to camp here.
So the U.S. has been, for over a decade, giving up continental United States territory.
Precisely. And it's exactly a direct parallel to 1916 when you had Pancho Villa. It was a civil war in Mexico after the Mexican
Revolution. Hold on. Let's recap it with Stuart Rhodes, who, again, has his law degree and is an expert, and also worked in Congress, to get into where we currently are, what the president needs to do next. But I think this is a big step in the right direction. I don't want to give the president too much heat for this, but you're right. It's not even an emergency. It's just his duty. Stuart Rhodes, founder of Oath Keepers, Army veteran, good friend of mine. I've known him probably 16, 17 years since he started the organization. And, of course, a Yale law graduate. Used to practice law. Don't do that anymore. Full-time. What's going on at you know, the nation fighting for its survival. And some stations don't care the last 5 minutes. So let's recap this. We're not criticizing the president. Overall, I think what you're saying is we're defending what he's done, but he doesn't need this 1970s law to declare this emergency when the continental country's being threatened and the UN's running it and things are collapsing. You've got drug cartels taking over major towns all over the Southwest. He better be doing what he's doing.
Yeah, he needs to do it as the commander-in-chief, though, instead of putting it only in the box of fighting crime and, you know, drugs and human trafficking. He needs to articulate the reality that the cartels are military enemies. And the direct parallel, which is very important, is Pancho Villa. When Pancho Villa and his bandits took over northern Mexico, Mexico City could not stop them, could not control them. Just like today, Mexico City can't stop the cartels. And when Pancho Villa raided,
so you don't play games and stuff, you just wipe them out.
Well, yeah. When Pancho Villa raided into Texas and killed 18 Americans, the cartel has killed far more than that, obviously.
Thousands.
Yeah, thousands. And so Wilson, President Wilson, 1916, responded to this situation by sending the U.S. military down, a National Guard, down to the border to secure the border. And then he said, then he sent General Black Jack Pershing into Mexico to take it to Pancho Villa and go hunt him down. So that's what they did back then. It was a military defense of the nation.
And again, it's a defense. We're not even, it's not a technical invasion to take the country. You have to go into the base and take it out.
Well, yeah, because Mexico City could, the nominal leader of Mexico at the time, the president of Mexico, could not control his own territory, could not control Mexico. And so the U.S. Army had to go do it. And we're in a similar situation. Mexico City does not control northern Mexico. The cartels do.
That's right. Mexico is a fallen, failed state.
It's a fallen narco state, a failed narco state. I mean, we just heard in the El Chapo trial that the prior president of Mexico got a $100 million bribe. So you could even say that right now Mexico is being run by the cartels. Much like the Taliban took over Afghanistan, the cartels have taken over Mexico. But if you want to give respect to the Mexican government, you say, well, look, either you have to fix this or we will. And they have failed to do it. And so we could.
Now, let's be clear. We don't want to invade Venezuela. We don't want to invade Mexico. But we can't fight it on our border. If they're failed, collapsed states, it's like building a seawall from the Gulf of Mexico. It's like we have to go in there and stop it.
You may have to. I think President Trump, and especially given the reality of the absurdity of the courts in the United States interpreting the asylum laws to allow anybody who sets foot on U.S. soil to be automatically processed for asylum and then cut and released in the United States, he may have no choice but to go into Mexico to stop them there and to take it to the cartels to prevent them from getting on U.S. soil. But even if he doesn't do that right now, he should articulate this. He shouldn't say, I'm going to go, you know, try to find and scrounge up money that's discretionary as the president to enforce the laws. What he should say is, as commander in chief, I'm going to use that massive military budget we have of $1.3 trillion, and I'm going to use that just like I do in Korea. We guard the DMZ in Korea. We guard the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
But we can't guard our own border.
We can't guard our own border. It makes no sense at all. We used to have the army on the border. That before there was a border patrol, it was the obligation and duty of the U.S. Army. There are forts every 50 miles along the border staffed by Army soldiers. That's what we have to get back to because that's what it's going to take.
And by the way, there were a couple million illegal aliens here. It was out of control with what they were doing. And Eisenhower, in like a month, rounded them all up. I mean,
right back in the 50s.
I mean, it wasn't a joke. It was just like,
yeah, he did it. And so, you know, I think President Trump, I think what he's trying to do the right thing. But my suspicion is that we all know, is he is surrounded by deep state agents. We just learned of an attempted coup to use the 25th Amendment. And I'm sure he still has people like that.
And how crazy, like used to, that'd be a huge story. Now it's like, oh, yeah, there was a 25th Amendment coup and they tried to do this. And, yeah, you know, they're on the payroll, the Chinese, the government. I mean, it's like, wow, we are so sold out.
Exactly. And as, you know, as Alan Dershowitz said last night on Tucker Carlson, that was clearly a coup. It's, you know, the constitutional remedy, if you believe the president is committing felonies, is to go and
impeachment.
Right. Impeachment. That's constitutional remedy. The 25th Amendment is all about incapacity. Is the president injured? Like when Reagan was shot, is he able to?
Yeah, that's only one degree away from blowing the president's head off. When you're trying to use 25th Amendment and all that.
Sure. Well, they're removing him through an unconstitutional means, and they're doing it by collusion between the DOJ and his own legal counsel and the FBI behind his back. It's like 7 days in May.
I want to get to that in the next segment because that's really big, and I'm glad you brought that up because we just get punch drunk to the insane times we live in. That's validated everything we've been warning of, everything we talked about. But we were always used to having a globalist in office. It's the weird juxtapose of we've got a quasi, you know, guy trying in there, and he's under siege, we're under siege, but we're winning in many ways because we've kind of fought into a stalemate. And then you've got the paradox, though, of the Democrats not standing when Trump says we saved 3,000 women and hundreds of kids in sex slavery and, we're stopping child pornographers, which is, and then they won't stand up for that. It shows. And then, oh, MS-13 are God's children. I know Democrats locally in Austin. They all run illegal immigration chains. They're dealing drugs. They're feeding on the poor underclass they're bringing in. But, I mean, we have to understand the Democratic Party has fully converted to an insane mafia.
It's like mass gaslighting. They're doing all these things right in front of your face, and then they tell you, that's not happening. There's no crime on the border. There's no one being murdered on the border. Like today during the
Acosta.
Right.
These are real mothers holding up their dead kids, and Acosta doesn't exist.
There's no crime there, even though they're right in front of him. So it's like,
well, let him actually go down the border for real and not just walk around behind a wall and see how much crime there is.
Sorry. Oh, absolutely.
Well, that was quite an interview. We'll end up with Leo Zagami from Rome, and he's going to give us insights about the Vatican. They're unbelievable. Here we go now.
Going back to Leo Zagami, best-selling author, researcher, lives in Rome, leozagami.com. Look, you're getting into all the facts, all the issues, all the people. You literally, 15 years ago when I first read your work, 10 years ago when I first started having you on, you were so confident, you laid it all out, it all came true. So let me ask you this, or have you lost your crystal ball? And I'm saying sometimes I have as well. What's coming next, Leo Zagami?
There is a connection that I found out which will explain where we're going next. Okay, there is a direct connection that will explain where we are going in the future, because I found this incredible link between the Jesuits, Cardinal Parolin, the Secretary of State, Pier Giorgio Bassi from the Academy of the Illuminati, John Podesta in Moscow, and a particular office in Moscow of this group that wants to dominate the world, which is called the International Organization for the Destinies of the World, behind the real Russian collusion. They are the ones who are plotting for the return in power of people from the Democratic Power, the Democratic Party that they have always worked with. And, of course, where we're going is towards a demonic situation in which the artificial intelligence takes over, we get silenced, they place in power all these people that are just robots, because we have seen that the left wing are just acting as robots, and of course the demonic forces will prosper and take over the system if we don't stop them. So, I mean, we are at a crucial point in history, and you have said this over and over again on your show, and I also endorse your products because you're doing a great job in surviving with InfoWars. And we are trying to survive because this is still a voice of freedom, but we don't know for how long, because this legion of demons is growing more and more powerful each day, and they control the artificial intelligence, they control Silicon Valley. So for how long are we going to be allowed to even talk on the World Wide Web? Is this a matter of time? So this is where we are going, Alex.
That was my next question. They lie to Congress. They lied. Total censorship is taking place. Total attacks. They're openly trying to sexualize children. Pedophilia is being announced in the news is a good thing. There's a coming out. I see that as a sign of weakness. But as you said, the enemy does control the technocracy.
They absolutely control the technocracy, because I have evidence in my new book, volume 6.66, that John Podesta met with Pier Giorgio Bassi to discuss some very delicate matters that they, regard alien life, that apparently these aliens, who are demonic aliens, are feeding information to Moscow that they can then use to take over the planet. This is what is happening. The Jesuits are in on it. Cardinal Parolin sent the head of the Jesuit Astronomic Observatory to Moscow through Pier Giorgio Bassi to discuss this whole thing, because even...
All right, let's stop right there. I got Stuart Rhodes coming up. I want to do 5 more minutes with you, because here's the deal. I'm a Christian. I believe in God, but I don't never seen a flying saucer. I don't get into Bigfoot, Chupacabras, Easter bunnies, Keebler elves, Santa Claus, or socialism working. I don't believe in it. But when you study San Francisco and you study the CIA, they're taking drugs, they believe interdimensionally, to talk to aliens in another dimension. That's their cult. Then you look, exactly, you're saying Moscow, and yeah, they believe they're in contact. Well, then why is the U.S. been given all the advanced technology? But when you talk to the average elitist, the average billionaire, I've talked to some of them, like Elon Musk has come out against all this. They believe they're in contact with off-world or interdimensional entities. And so you're bringing up this bombshell information because that's what this all comes down to.
There is a specific group that is called the Expert Management Unit of General Staff, and there is actually an academic, important academic in Russia called Natalia Beketereva, and then there is Lieutenant General Alexei Savin. These people with the Jesuits, they are doing and working for the real Russian collusion with these demonic forces, and I have the evidence for it now.
Hold on. You've said so much has been true over the years about the Vatican. You've been trailblazer. And I'm not even defending Russia. You said Russia was good with Berlusconi. What about San Francisco and how they think they're working with the off-world influence?
They're already controlled, Alex. They are completely already, they have submitted. That's why, you know, John Podesta and all those people have already made a deal with Silicon Valley. Obama.
So wait. You're saying the Russians are now making the deal with the off-world group?
Yeah, of course. That's what they're doing, and we have the evidence here. I'm not talking about conspiracy theories. I have evidence that I'm showing in my new book, which is called Volume 6.66, and it's going to create a stir because this evidence has accurate sources, very accurate, and I'm not just bragging. There is serious journalists.
Well, let's be clear. We're on a planet in deep space. Whether you believe in entities or the devil or God or not, the elites believe, from Skull and Bones to all these groups, to Aleister Crowley, that they're getting divine influence from angels or entities. And then the stuff they get, like Darwin had hallucinations that became everything. So did Galton. Biometrics, the DNA, they were given, I would not say divine, but demonic inspiration. And so what we're talking about is what the elite believe. Doesn't mean we believe it. Doesn't mean it's all real. This is their religion. So I'm going to get Leo Zagami's take on that when we come back. Stay with us. On a tiny little galaxy out of trillions, two-thirds of the way out of the spiral arm. Leo Zagami, best-selling author, researcher in Rome, is our guest, finishing up with him. Just the fantastical nature of mainstream news admitting that the Vatican is a giant homosexual orgy facility with a bunch of dead kids getting raped in every major diocese from Austin, Texas, to Boston, Massachusetts, to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania is just a giant cult, an army that took over the church, and now it's all coming out. What are they going to do? I think their answer is bring in a war, bring in tyranny, bring in suppression. I think we're seeing their answer. And like you said, what is the secret society nature? If the devil's fallen, not of this world, but now the God of this world, what does the God of this world want? What's the end game?
They wanted the birth of the Antichrist. The Anno Satanae 1 was 1966. They're well overdue, the arrival of the Antichrist. This is not a joke. The Vatican has been reformed to facilitate the demons. In 1999, they even reformed their own exorcism rite. So now they are like giving just a couple of signs of the cross instead than 14 or 12 more. I mean, they have reformed the whole Catholic liturgy to facilitate this demonic possession of our society, because the rite of exorcism is the only rite that can stop these creatures, these demons that talk with Russia, facilitate Russia, but Russia then plays both sides of the game, and of course, then you are tricked in it, because behind there is these demonic forces, and they are with the Vatican totally in league together. So they have transformed the Vatican in this gay pedophile sect, so then they can welcome the Antichrist. And they have done it already, Alex, in 1963. And Father Malachi Martin was a victim of these demons. We are fighting a war here with entities that are not of this world, that possess our politicians, our religious leaders. This has to be taken very seriously before it gets out of control. Because the moment the artificial intelligence plan gets everything, then Cyber Satan will simply enslave this race. So we need to understand this.
They'll have an omnipresent system temporarily interface with a spiritual system, finally giving the demonic projection real-world eyes and ears.
Yes. For them, God is dead, Satan lives. These are full-on Satanists. Pope Francis, is a perfectly possessed person. He is basically controlled by a demon, and every time the camera goes slightly offset and you basically catch him off guard, that maybe doing a photo, you can see the demon in his eyes. Pope Francis is possessed. This means that the Catholic Church is literally the biggest church of Satan, let alone...
Catholic Church has become the seat of Satan.
Yes, and then, of course, they endorse the satanic temple in the U.S. that can be pro-abortion. Abortions, and of course, they need...
And by the way, Leo, as you said, make no mistake, you have Governor of Virginia saying we kill babies after they're born. You have New York celebrating it and cackling like witches. This is all lesser magic, as they call it, in our face, celebrating the killing.
It's Moloch all over again. They need the soul of these infants. They can do it with abortion. They can do it with rituals.
Exactly. So what does the souls, what does oppressing children give them? Why are they so oppressed with the innocent?
Because they are offering them to the gods, so the gods then in turn give them power. So they are enslaved by these demons, by these alien demons, because they have to sacrifice and sacrifice and sacrifice if they want to maintain this power. We have to stop...
Just like the Babylonians, just like the Aztecs, just like the Druids, why do groups get in control that just demand more dead children? It's just something gets control and demands dead kids. Why would humans want to kill their own children? We wouldn't.
Alex, they do it for power. These are not, these are people who stop in front of nothing. 500 years ago, Caterina de' Medici sacrificed a child celebrating the first Black Mass in Paris that became the worldwide capital of Satanism because her own son was sick and then she had other problems. So, okay, she celebrated with a Catholic priest because the real Black Mass can only be celebrated by a Catholic priest. People don't understand this, but even Aleister Crowley said it, even Anton LaVey, if you want the
ultimate... Because they have to have the blasphemy of it done in the church by a priest.
Yes.
That is the perfect inversion.
Of course, because if you are not a holy person, if you have not been blessed with the lineage of St. Peter and of Jesus, then you're just a normal person, you're a normal folk, no? That's why today is very important for them to save McCarrick from being completely defrocked, because he celebrates satanic masses. The moment they defrock him, McCarrick can't celebrate them anymore. So, dear McCarrick, maybe your career as a Satanist is finished altogether. Who knows? This is what is happening.
We're going to break. I want to have you back up soon. And then Stuart Roosevelt Cooper's got huge news coming up next segment. And we've got other big guests today. But I see the Satanists are on the offense. They also seem very scared right now. Do you agree with that, A and B? Why are they so scared?
They're scared because, of course, we are finally seeing them clearly and more clearly because they can't help themselves. In Italy, there was a festival called Sanremo Festival. They even had the courage of saying five times Satan in a kind of, it was supposed to be a comedy sketch, and instead at one point they said, Satana, 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 Satana. And it's now all over the news. Even the Vatican had to criticize this festival of Sanremo for invoking Satan. I mean, in Italy, we're invoking Satan on public TV. This is crazy. This is insane, Alex.
Well, we had the head of the EU say, Satan rejects you, Brexit. I mean, we go to pro-life events and people show up and say, we love Satan. It's so crazy. Leo Zagami, leozagami.com. Great job. We'll talk to you soon, my friend. Anytime you've got breaking news, text the producers and please come on.
Thank you, Alex. All the best. God bless America.
God bless you.
We've got to keep our minds open. I know some of these ideas being put forward or assertions might be really sound off the wall. But let's keep an open mind on this. And people like Leo Zagami and Alex Jones and myself, we've spent decades, each one of us, in studying this world system. So what we might say at times might seem a little bit far-fetched, but it's not as far-fetched as you might think. But I want to thank everybody for listening out there, and thank you so very much for listening and supporting us. And we're just trying to bring you a little bit of the truth, and then you can go out and research and double-check us and so forth. But thank you for listening. Good night.